Welcome to the Ministry of Truth. This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. On today's show, we'll discuss the formal model of participatory economics in anticipation of a teach-in at the University of Chicago in October 2005 on the topic. We'll include an excerpt of an interview with Michael Albert, one of the co-inventors of participatory economics. We'll also include a feature of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes. But first, these headlines from around the web and around the world. From The New Standard. College students across the United States on September 28, 2005, kicked off a campaign aimed at forcing 40 different institutions to abandon tacit approval of sweatshop labor practiced by the world's largest collegiate apparel providers. Organized by United Students Against Sweatshops, the campaign is calling on the colleges and universities to require companies that require school logo garments to commit to providing safe work conditions and a living wage. The Sweat-Free Campus campaign is the second leg of the student group's seven-year-long battle to force higher education institutes in the United States to reject garments made by people earning poverty wages in dangerous factories. From the Guerrilla News Network. In 2005, the oil giant Mobil denied any toxics were on the premises of their Liberian facility when, according to The Analyst, a report said that toxic chemicals, which have been stored in some 68 drums containing 3,105 kilograms of STK2414, a noted toxic chemical, and methanol mixture at the Mobil compound since 1995, have been leaking into the soil for several months without any attempt to safely dispose of them. But now Mobil is working with the Environmental Protection Agency in Ghana and Liberia to survey and test the site in preparation for cleanup work. Plans to supposedly dispose of the waste are still murky. Environmental restoration work in Liberia is a key to cementing the peace. Without a sustainable and safe environment, Liberia has no future. From Human Rights Watch. A Belgian judge has issued an international arrest warrant charging Chad's former dictator, Hissène Habré, with atrocities during his rule from 1982 to 1990. Habré, known as an African Pinochet, lives in exile in Senegal, where he was indicted in 2000 before courts ruled that he could not be tried there. Belgium is now formally seeking Habré's extradition from Senegal to stand trial. From The New Standard. Opening a landmark case on September 26, 2005, lawyers representing a group of parents sought to prevent a school from continuing to force what they see as religion into the science curriculum. The trial begins even as scientists continue to uncover more information detailing the continuing evolution of life on the planet. Brought by 11 parents of ninth grade students in a small Pennsylvania town, Kitzmiller et al. V. Dover Area School District is the first trial about evolution in nearly 20 years. Proponents of intelligent design claim theirs is a legitimate science. As part of the school board's decision, science teachers must inform students that the recently published textbook of Pandas and People, The Central Question of Biological Origins, Explaining the Intelligent Design Theory, is in the school library. Leading biologists and education specialists have largely and resoundingly discredited the scientific basis of the book. In an assessment of the text for the National Association of Biology Teachers, Richard P. Owley, an evangelical Christian, warns that the book's science is extremely flawed and that the text is really a, quote, pragmatic maneuver in the present-day controversy, unquote. From Feministing.com. Hundreds of Pakistani women marched on September 29, 2005, in protest against recent remarks made by Pakistan's president about rape victims. The BBC reports that protesters carried banners and placards and heard speeches denouncing Pervez Musharraf's comments made in the United States. In Islamabad, human rights activist Hina Jilani told crowds that the president's remarks were an insult to women and called for an unqualified apology from Mr. Musharraf. The rally, held close to the presidential palace and Pakistan's parliament, was organized by the Joint Action Committee, a grouping of women's groups and human rights activists. Many Pakistani women routinely face abuse and rape in a male-dominated society. Incidents of violent abuse have caused outrage in recent years, with victims like Mukhtaran Mai and Dr. Shazia Khalid highlighting the issue. Ms. Mai, an illiterate 33-year-old woman, was attacked in 2002, apparently on the orders of a village council. One commentator for Feministing.com remarks, "I'm betting there will be no apology." From Democracy Now!, a new study shows that 6 in 10 women who have served in the National Guard and Reserves said they were sexually harassed or assaulted. The study says that less than a quarter reported it, and many who did were encouraged to drop the complaint. The survey, conducted by the Department of Veterans Affairs, found that nearly half of the women who responded said the sexual assaults occurred while they were on duty. From The New Standard. Speaking to an audience at Juilliard College, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia said in late September 2005 that the government should end funding for the arts. And Scalia maintained that if Washington must continue supporting artists, withholding funds from art it disagrees with is perfectly acceptable. The pronouncement reiterated the justice's prior statements and further elucidated recent court decisions while prompting quick criticism from free speech advocates. Scalia's statements came as part of a panel discussion on art and society in the United States, which included a noted opera singer, a songwriter, and a conservative lawyer. Moderated by Juilliard President Joseph Polisi, the debate became strained at several points when the lyricist Stephen Sondheim and Antonin Scalia squared off on artistic expression, according to a report in the New York Times. From Democracy Now!, the United Nations reports the government of Burma continues to imprison more than 1,100 political prisoners, including Nobel Peace Laureate and pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi. A report delivered by a United Nations Human Rights Envoy to the General Assembly documented forced labor, sexual violence, extortion, and expropriation committed by troops in the ruling military junta. Meanwhile, outside the United Nations, several Burmese pro-democracy activists have continued a hunger strike. From the Guerrilla News Network. The European Union has passed 3 major new laws on environmental protection. REACH, Registration, Evaluation, and Assessment of Chemical Hazard; ROSE, the Restriction of Hazardous Substances; and WEE, spelled W-E-E-E, the Directive on Waste Electronic and Electric Equipment. GNN reports REACH will put the lack of effective chemical safety regulations in the United States to shame. ROSE will eliminate 6 toxic substances ubiquitous in the electronics industry: lead, mercury, cadmium, hexavalent chromium, PBBs, and PBDEs. WEE makes manufacturers responsible for the costs of recycling, creating a serious economic incentive for product designs that have efficient resource reuse options built in. Grist magazine describes these groundbreaking new laws as an opportunity for the European Union to, quote, successfully incubate tomorrow's global rules, unquote. From The New Standard. After months of rumor and new releases, the company that manufactures tasers announced on September 27, 2005, that the United States Security and Exchange Commission has launched a formal investigation of the company. At issue is the end-of-year sale of more than $1.5 million of the company's weapons. Moreover, SEC investigators are examining the company's product safety claims, Taser International said in a statement. The company questioned the integrity and honesty of the world's most respected human rights organization, Amnesty International, after Amnesty released a report outlining about 100 instances where the supposedly non-lethal weapon may have contributed to the deaths of captives and suspects of American law enforcement agencies. In 2005, a medical examiner became the first official in the United States to directly tie taser blasts to the death of an inmate. Other coroners have cited tasers as a contributing factor to death in a handful of other cases. From The New Standard. In what is thought to be the first case of its kind, a California judge in late September 2005 ordered one of the world's largest laundry goods suppliers to pay over $1 million to settle a claim brought by Haywood, California employees under the city's living wage ordinance. Unite Here, the union representing the workers, termed the ruling historic and vowed to continue its battle to force the company, Cintas, to abide by living wage laws. These are some headlines from around the world. We encourage you to visit and support online independent news efforts like The New Standard, newstandardnews.net, Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Guerrilla News Network, gnn.tv, Human Rights Watch, hrw.org, and Feministing, feministing.com. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
A leadership change at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting means more partisan mudslinging is likely. Controversial CPB chairman Ken Tomlinson's term ended on September 26th. He still sits on the board of directors but won't be able to pull any more stunts like hiring Republican operatives to dig dirt for a smear campaign against Bill Moyers. His replacement, however, is Cheryl Halpern. A member of the CPB board since 2002, Halpern was one of the top 100 individual donors to George W. Bush's re-election campaign. She's also a member of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees government-funded international broadcast projects. In that capacity, Halpern rabidly decried so-called liberalism within the Voice of America and went so far as to have a journalist physically removed from the studio for violating her perception of objectivity. The CPB board also has a new vice chair. She is Gay Hart Gaines. Gaines first gained prominence in Republican circles by chairing the Political Action Committee, which orchestrated a Republican takeover of Congress in 1994. Back then, Gaines worked closely on then-House Speaker Newt Gingrich's crusade to do away with public broadcasting.
Just as the leadership at the CPB veers further to the right, federal funds for public broadcasting go under the knife again. Some 100 Republicans in the House of Representatives are pushing for extraordinary spending cuts to several federal programs as a stopgap measure to cover costs associated with Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. One of their proposals calls for defunding all of public broadcasting immediately. This comes as public broadcasters in areas affected by the hurricanes continue to rebuild both themselves and the communities they serve. Public radio and TV stations are active in shelters for the displaced, working to connect people with job and housing placement services and handing out free books to kids.
The makers of TiVo call it an unfortunate bug, but the personal video recorder now gives content makers the capability to lock down any recorded program and restrict how long users can view them, even to the point of automatically deleting them if necessary. Such prohibitions, according to TiVo, are supposed to be restricted to pay-per-view type programs and other premium TV services, but some TiVo users report the copy protection showed up recently on some traditional over-the-air broadcast fare. Not all digital video recorders contain copy protection features. For example, the Electronic Frontier Foundation provides a manual online that teaches you step-by-step how to build and program an open-source PVR. In related news, the recording and motion picture industries are circulating talking points in Washington in support of legislation requiring digital TV and radio broadcasts be protected with copy protection technology. The FCC has already tried to force TV manufacturers to include copy protection in HDTV sets, but that's been struck down in court.
When local governments consider offering broadband internet access as a public utility, phone and cable companies aggressively lobby against such projects. But the tables are turned in Cleveland Heights, Ohio, where city officials are thinking of commandeering a fiber optic network initially built by the now bankrupt cable company Adelphia. The network currently links public buildings and schools, and the city would like to extend its reach by adding public wireless access points. However, Adelphia refuses to provide the city with necessary technical information to move ahead with network expansion. Eminent domain may be the only option left.
Disney deputizes Verizon to be on guard against illicit file sharing. In exchange for permission to carry a dozen Disney cable channels on its new fiber optic broadband network, Disney will keep watch on Verizon broadband customers and report any suspicious uploading and downloading it finds. Verizon will then contact tagged customers and ask them for a response to Disney's allegation. Unsatisfactory answers could result in immediate termination of broadband service. However, neither Verizon nor Disney have explained what the burden of proof will be in these cases, and while both parties have pledged to keep customer information confidential, there is no specific mechanism by which that is guaranteed.
When it comes to pundits pushing government propaganda, Armstrong Williams appears to be just the tip of the iceberg. Williams was paid $250,000 to push the No Child Left Behind Act in newspaper columns and on television. But a recently released report, sparked by the Williams disclosure, notes that the U.S. Department of Education spent more than $12 million to generate positive coverage of the law. This includes some $5 million which went toward publicity efforts that lacked appropriate disclosure about the government's involvement. Of that, $2 million went to PR firms and other consultants for which there is no record of any actual work being done.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
This is the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now present our feature of this episode, a discussion of a formal model of participatory economics in anticipation of a teach-in at the University of Chicago on the topic. This will include an excerpt of an interview with Michael Albert, one of the co-inventors of participatory economics. In recent decades, the world's economy has been dominated by the doctrine of neoliberalism, the idea that competitive market economics should command all aspects of life. The dominance of neoliberalism has stemmed in part from the University of Chicago's Department of Economics, whose graduates and faculty have tirelessly promoted neoliberalism in prominent academic, business, and government positions worldwide. The results have been fantastic for neoliberal advocates: a bevy of Nobel Prizes, ever-increasing profit levels for corporations, the collapse of centrally planned economies worldwide. At the same time, the results have been horrible for everyone and everything else: the shredding of social safety nets and public protections, rampant poverty and environmental destruction, and the persistence of the myth that, as bad as markets are, no other economic model is better. But now, that myth faces its greatest challenge: a new economic model which propels participation and equitable cooperation, a model that promotes both efficiency and diversity, a model which has defeated every theoretical challenge it has faced, and which defies both markets and centrally planned economies. And that model is coming to the University of Chicago, indeed to the very building where the University of Chicago Department of Economics used to call home. The Chicago Area Participatory Economic Society, or CAPES, presents the Chicago School of Participatory Economics, a teach-in about the economics of equitable cooperation. Learn about and critique an entirely new economic model with American University professor Robin Honnell, Tuesday, October 18, 2005, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the University of Chicago Campus Social Science Research Building, 1126 East 59th Street, room SS122. The cost is free. To learn more, visit the website of the Chicago Area Participatory Economic Society online at www.chicagoparecon.org. Participatory economics, or PAR-Econ, is an economic model invented by Robin Honnell and Michael Albert, which strives to achieve the economic goals of production, consumption, and allocation while promoting solidarity, equity, diversity, and self-management. Here is an excerpt of an interview with Michael Albert, one of the co-inventors of participatory economics, explaining some of the institutions that PAR-Econ uses to achieve the economic goals and values that PAR-Econ holds dear.
Key institutions of participatory economics are that no one owns means of production, no one owns factories and workplaces, that factories and workplaces include workers' councils and the communities include consumers' councils, and that these organs or institutions by which we get together and express our desires operate according to what's called participatory self-management. People get a say in decisions in proportion to the degree they're affected by them. That means we don't have the sharp hierarchies of power that are typical now. Another feature of participatory economics, in order to enable that kind of decision-making, is what's called balanced job complexes. That's a way of dividing up our work that's very different than now. Instead of some people, about 20% of the population, monopolizing, that is, holding to themselves empowering work, the work that involves knowledge of what's going on, that gives one a say over what's going on, that gives one skills and confidence and even energy to make decisions and to assert oneself, while 80% of the population is stuck with only tasks which are disempowering, which are boring and rote and tedious, which don't convey information and knowledge, and which leave one unable to express and assert one's desires. Instead of that kind of division of labor, which is what we endure now, participatory economics proposes what's called balanced job complexes. And in that setting, it isn't that we all do the same thing. We certainly don't. But each person does a combination of tasks such that the overall quality of life of their workday and empowerment effects of their workday are comparable to everyone else. Another key feature is how we remunerate. How much do we get? What do we earn? What claim on outputs do we have? In our economy, one of the factors that determines that is ownership of property. Since Bill Gates has a deed in his pocket to a lot of property, he's worth about as much as the population of four or five Latin American countries combined. People who don't own a deed don't get income that way in our economy. Another way that people get income in our economy is by virtue of the power that they can wield, how much bargaining power they bring to the table. Another way or another factor that influences it is how productive they are, how much output they can generate even by their own activity. Participatory economics rejects all of these as a basis for determining how much we get, and rather remunerates people, that is, gives people income, in accord with the effort that we expend and the sacrifice that we endure in socially useful labor. It's how hard we work, how long we work, how onerous our work is. Those are the things that we're remunerated for. And finally, in the economy that we're used to, something called allocation, the determination of who does what, how much goes where, how it is that what goes into a workplace matches what they need in order to produce what goes out of a workplace, is called allocation. In our economy, it's handled by what are called markets. In a participatory economy, there are no markets. Markets are eliminated, and in their place is a system called participatory planning, in which workers and consumers, I guess you could say, cooperatively negotiate the inputs and the outputs of the economy, the economy's plan or its activities. All this stuff is brought together into a system, into a coherent meshing of these institutions, and the purpose is to accomplish production, consumption, and allocation. After all, that's what an economy has to do, and to do it in a way that's consistent with values we hold dear.
That was Michael Albert explaining some of the institutions of participatory economics. To learn more about PariCon, go to the website of the PariCon Project online at www.parecon.org, spelled PareCon. You're listening to the Ministry of Truth.